So, as Sean just said, I'm here from Berkeley, and I have things to say about closed stream tachyon condensation in a particular system, in the E8 heterodic system. Just to highlight this fact, I'm not talking E8 cross E8. This is a single E8 at level 2. So it is tachyonic, and it's not supersymmetric in spacetime. This is based on two papers with my advisor, Petr Hrdlička. Please don't ask me to pronounce his name again. I try not to because I can't do it right. Both back in September. So before I get started too much, I want to talk a little bit about why we think closed string tachyon condensation is an interesting problem. So one of the reasons that we think it's interesting is that string theory generally has a hard time discussing backgrounds that are strongly time dependent. We don't have a simple way of, our normal way, if we start with Joe's book and learn how to do string theory, is on flat backgrounds that don't do time-dependent things. And most of our progress in string theory has been made in that direction. It turns out that for certain kinds of limited cases, closed string tachyons can actually be analyzed. This is one of those cases. And hopefully we can, through this, learn something more about what we can say about time-dependent situations in general. I should mention that quite a lot has been done on open string tachyon condensation, and that's a much better understood system. The main difference in the difficulty here is that we're doing nasty things to the space-time as a whole, as opposed to just the D-brains that open strings lived on. And we don't generally have a great way of describing what happens when, say, space-time decays at late times. We don't really know what that means. And so the approach we're going to take here is talking completely from a world sheet perspective. So we don't have to worry about what happens to the space-time picture until after we've done some analysis on the world sheet. So now I should go on and give you a little bit of a reason as to why we decided that this particular E8 model is interesting. And for that, we'll have to jump to heterodic M theory. In which we're going to consider an E8 and E8 bar brain. So the normal setup, if you wanted to get, say, E8 cross E8 heterodic strings out, is to start with two E8 planes. Watch what happens, and you end up with, you can describe a string theory with E8 cross E8 as your gauge group. But what we want to do is something a little bit different. So much like when you take a D-D bar system, here we're going to take an E8 E8 bar. And see what happens in the M theory, and what sort of system do we end up getting out of it. So there are two things that happen. First of all, you get a Casimir force between the two planes. They attract each other. And second of all, there's an instanton, which we sort of schematically depicted like this. Here, R11 is the distance in the extra dimension between the two planes.
So how do you realize this? What do you mean by E8 bar?
What do you mean by E8 bar? It's the same thing that's meant by a D bar when you say D bar in a set of brains.
Okay, for D brains, okay, you have Wallace's prescription for defining it, for example. Okay, you can say, for example, the boundary state has much.
Sure. So I have to be honest, I'm not super familiar with this description. This is something that Petr and Michael Fabinger worked out 5 years ago or so. And this is just background motivation for why. I can point you to the reference if you're interested in more details about it.
I think you just changed the orientation on one of the boundaries. So you have the line segment at the two edges, and you change the orientation on one of the frames of supersymmetry.
And you will note that you don't end up with a space-time supersymmetry when you're in the theory that we'll end up with.
Do you mean write the same bulk action that changes the sign that corresponds to the orientation on one trace? The same bulk plus boundary actions.
Yeah. And you do end up with an instanton whose nucleation probability is dependent on this distance here, such that when the distance is small, it's relatively likely to happen. And the distance will get small because we have this Casimir force, so they are actually going to be attracted to each other over time. The details of that aren't particularly important, but this is the effective 10-dimensional Newton constant, if you wanted to know. And so the idea is that if you go to a small enough R11, you should start to see this as some perturbative effect. We think that the perturbative effect that you're seeing it as is this tachyon that's present in the E8 heterotic string. So to give a little bit more reason why we think the E8 heterotic string may be a good world sheet description of what happens when this tachyon, when this instanton has occurred, I should say a few more words about what that string has. So the first thing is that the current algebra that the E8 is realized as is actually realized at level 2, which is similar to the setup that you get when you start with two brains and then look at what the diagonal UN that you get is. That's also recognized at, or realized at level 2. So that's reminiscent of the same story anyways. The tachyon that we end up with when you look at the spectrum of the E8 heterotic string is just a singlet tachyon under the gauge symmetry. It's also, we only have that one tachyon in the E8 heterotic string. Most of the other tachyonic heterotic strings end up with larger numbers of tachyons, 4 or 16 or 32. 32? Yeah, I think you can. It's also true that the spectrum, when we look at the heterotic string, is non-chiral, and you get both both sets of fermions are represented. Once again, very similar to this brain anti-brain story.
Sorry, this is the system before the E8. This E8, just a single E8.
Just a single E8 is what we think the system is after.
I would have thought there was one on each wall, but you said it somehow hangs down to a diagonal.
Right, and so we can only we're saying that we think it's the what you get afterwards. Sort of. If I can go back up here. Sorry, I don't actually know how to go backwards easily, but that does it.
So you mean afterwards is after the equation?
What I mean by afterwards is inside here.
Oh, it's not a bubble of nothing. It's a bubble of.
Well, we think that it's a description of, so if you let these two come close together, we think it's a description, the tachyon condensation is a description, tachyon condensation in this E8 is a description of this bubble forming here. And it does actually end up being similar to a bubble of nothing. All degrees of freedom will be repelled from that region. But we actually can give you a world sheet description of what happens at least once they start close together. We think so. I should make a quick comment that this is sort of heuristic motivation. I don't have a way to go from the actual M-theory picture and show you that the particular E8 heterotic system that we're considering is exactly the same thing. However, there's no other good candidate that has the same set of properties that I'm describing on this slide.
I guess there is no non-supersymmetric E8 across the E8 string.
Right. You can't make that.
Right.
And all of the other ones that have tachyons either have too many tachyons, or they don't get an E8 gauge group like we'd expect, a diagonal one like this guy, or they're missing some of these setups here. I should also point out that the analog to a brain anti-brain system, really you should be considering adding an orbifold to that, because you want to have both the Casimir force and the instanton present, and so it's really more analogous to that setup.
Just to make sure, so the state, your conjecture is that the M-theory drift of the E8 heterotic string theory is the E8 cross E8 bar. M-theory. Is that correct?
When you allow those two planes to be close to enough to each other, yeah.
And that corresponds to weak coupling.
Right.
So what happens if they collide, and then what is
the... Well, so the idea is that as they get closer together, the instanton overpowers the Casimir force, and so what really happens is you get this sort of bubble of nothing that forms.
But what is this bubble of nothing?
We'll talk more about that. We'll come back to that. That's what we're hoping to be able to describe by moving to this heterotic theory on the world sheet.
Just an question. In the case of the DD bar system, there's an energy associated with this DD bar. So after the collision, the energy of the DD bar becomes the core string energy, right?
Right.
So where's the energy of this E8 end of the world core energy go if it's made of nothing? Where's the energy go?
Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
It's like the Witten bubble of nothing story. It goes in the effectively it's in the bubble walls. The bubble walls continue to accelerate as it expands.
So the energy goes into the bubble
as well. Yeah. So it's the bubble carrying the energy away from the system as it expands.
But I should say that we can't do a precise analysis from the perspective of the two brains. What our analysis focuses on is assuming that we are interested in this particular heterotic string,
suppose
what happens?
Suppose there's no instantons and everything collides simultaneously with a boundary.
Well, I don't know what that would mean because there is an instanton. And I guess our description is that the instanton is the decay of this tachyon. So if you want to write down what the heterotic string is, it has this tachyon and it will condense.
I think what she's saying is that the heterotic EA heterotic string that she's starting with is the EA, an EA bar grain on top of each other at zero velocity.
Right.
She's not letting them actually fall in. In this case, you're just sort of starting on top of each other, no kinetic energy, but it's clearly unstable, and that's the tachyon that she sees in the weak threshold theory.
I see there's no tension with this end of the water going, right? Are there any tension with this end of the
That's the top of the tachyon potential.
Sorry, one more question. You mentioned this orbital, and actually, did you say it was an orbital in some place?
I'm sorry, that's what I meant.
I just wanted to keep track of, from this block picture, if I have put the EA bar where I change the sign, then does that mean that I really should have an orientable in this bulk picture as well to cancel all the tadpoles? I've now sort of got two, or do these,
how
charges are different than the EA cross EA system, right?
They are definitely different.
Yeah. Surely I have to have the charges add up to zero in some sense because these are into the world grains.
That does make sense, but I'm not really sure what the setup is to make that something that's
stable. One more step. I was wondering if this has anything to do with getting one E8 instead of two out of the system.
How so?
Well, if I take some D2 quotient, do I get rid of an E8? I'm just asking.
Well, I think it's the same. It seems to me like it's very similar to the setup with starting with a full set of two different UNs when you have D brains, but then when they're actually coincident, you don't have that anymore.
Oh, they're coincident, you don't have two, as you say. You don't?
Don't you end up with just the single UN, or do you have to start with orientifolds on your planes in order to get that? I think you might have to.
The usual story was a D and a D bar coincident does give you a U2N, but then various things happen.
Well, I think the various things happening is that this Higgsing of that symmetry is the same kind of thing that we're going to see happen here. It's a little complicated to make the connection until I actually finish, but ask me again. We'll come back to that a little bit. Okay. It's also the case, just drawing the connection between this E8, E8 bar system and our conjecture that the E8 heterotic string is the right model for that when they're close together. It's the case that if you start with regular E8 and two E8 planes, and you do a Z2 overfold of that, you can get this E8, E8 bar system. Very similarly, if you start with the E8 cross E8 heterotic string, you can do a similar Z2 orbifold, end up with the E8 single E8 heterotic string. Okay. So leaving that in the past for a little bit, I'd like to go ahead and just separately of any motivation discuss what happens to the tachyon in this E8 system. So what I've written up here is this is the action for any free fermion description of a heterotic model in 10 dimensions. Let me point out what we've got here. And you'll notice I haven't actually picked a gauge yet, and the reason I haven't is that we're going to not pick superconformal gauge. We'll pick the conformal part, but we're not going to set the gravitino to be zero. We don't want to, because it turns out the gravitino is going to be propagating at late times, and if we set it to zero, it'd be very difficult to see that. So we would prefer not to. So I'm going to start just without doing that. So pointing out what things are, this is... Oh, there is. Lovely. Okay. So this is just our regular space-time metric. This is the world sheet metric. X is what you'd expect. Psi is what you'd expect. But this chi here, I just want to point out what the notation is because everybody seems to use a different notation for what the gravitino is. And we're using gravitino as chi here. This extra term is the one that you usually don't see because, of course, we set the gravitino to zero in superconformal gauge and you don't end up with it. But we will have to keep track of this term and a few others that appear when we do modifications of this action later. Then these lambda here are the free fermions. There are 32 of them. And F are the auxiliary fields that lambda transforms into under supersymmetry. We also want to leave these explicit for now, although soon the 31 of them will go away, because the tachyon will happen when this F receives a BEV. And so we want to keep them explicit. So just step back. And also, we still have a gravitino because we haven't gauge fixed yet. The way that you specify which particular heterotic model you're interested in is to list what periodicities are actually going to contribute to the sum over spin structures here. I'm not going to list them out for you because it turns out that there are quite a lot of them for the E8 case that we're talking about. The point that is important for our case is that it turns out you'll allow for all spin structures of 31 of the fermions set up in a particular way in sets of 8 to make sure that you always maintain modular invariance. Details of this are available in a paper by Kwai, Llewellyn, and I think Henry Tai is on that paper too, from several years ago. But the end result being that if you allow all of the periodicities for the lambda except one of them to range over all possibilities, then this lambda has to always be the same setup as psi. So the spin structure of one of the fermions will be the same as the spin structure of the supersymmetric side fermion psi. We'll call that fermion the lone fermion. And as of right now, it's the only one we're going to keep writing. We'll call it just plain lambda because it's the only one we'll keep writing. Why is that? Well, because all the others can be written as the level 2 current algebra, the E8, which gives us the central charge that we would expect. It's kind of cute that that works out. But it's also nice for us because it means we don't have to keep carrying around these free fermions. We can just say the current algebra takes care of that part, and we'll see what happens with following through with the details later. Okay. That is the next slide. Okay. So the next thing that we do, and I'm hoping that this is just for ease of analysis, because I think it complicates the physical picture a little bit. It does make the analysis much easier. We add a linear dilaton. The reason why is because this lets us keep conformal invariance when we add our tachyon condensate. And I should mention that in both cases, we're going to require the linear dilaton to start out being null, and the tachyon condensate will also have to be null. The reason this is important, I was talking with Sean about this a little bit earlier, and it's definitely a concern of ours in being able to analyze tachyon condensation in general, because a lot of the work, such as work that Simeon Hellerman, Ian Swanson, and other people from Princeton have been doing, is really only being able to analyze what happens in tachyon condensation along some null boundary. What you aren't specifically able to do then, you know, they like drawing these diagrams like this, but we don't know what happens here. We don't have a good description of the actual nucleation of the tachyon. So I was saying before, you know, I can say what the probability is to nucleate this instanton when we go back to the E88 bar system. But here I have no good description of that actual nucleation. All I can say is what happens when we consider at some time after that happens. So zooming in on only some region where it's a good approximation to say that tachyon condensation is already progressing along some null wall.
The light-like tachyon condensate means there's a light-like boundary to tachyon condensate. The main wall is light-like, right? The tachyon condensate is sort of sitting inside doing whatever it does.
Right, but basically the vertex operator we add looks something like this, where x plus is a light-like direction. Okay. And so the boundary ends up being something that's light-like. I would love to be able to actually give a description of what happens here. But there are several reasons that's a difficult thing to do, and one is that it's not even clear this is exactly what we really want. It seems to me like what we really would want is some description of a time-like condensation. Because if we want to describe something like this, well, then I have to ask what happens if I have a nucleation slightly later and then they run into each other, and that's even more complicated. I certainly don't have any way to describe that. But this is stuff that we hope to be able to look at in the future. For now, we're going to concentrate on just the part we can describe, which is this null system. In order to be able to describe that well, we also have to add this linear dilaton. We're hoping that its major effect is to give us a handle on keeping conformal invariants. What it does mean is that for the region of our spacetime when that dilaton is large, we don't really have control over what's going on. But we can consider the other region and hopefully have control and be able to make some points.
Is linear dilaton natural from the bulk perspective that you motivated this with originally? I mean, is there some reason why the dilaton should be?
I don't see it. And this is something that Petter and I talked about for a while, but that's part of the reason that I'm hoping, and I do say hope here because I don't think I have a good reason to believe it, that I'm hoping that it isn't a physical thing, that it's something that we're doing really for mathematical convenience, because I don't think there is a good way to see it. If you have a good way, I'd love to hear about it.
No, I certainly don't.
Okay.
By that, you would mean that if you got rid of it, you think that, what would happen if you get rid of it?
We would hope that the analysis, so basically, just to give you a preview, what we were able to do is get a good world sheet description at late times in a different gauge. And we're hoping that although that particular description isn't going to actually hold, if we don't have conformal invariants, we can't really trust it, that the physics that we get would hold if you turn this off.
So your linear dilaton, does it go to strong coupling at late time? Or
well, it depends what you mean by late time. At large x, the linear dilaton goes in the opposite light cone direction.
Oh, the opposite.
Right. So that you can pick, so if x plus is going this way, then the linear dilaton is going the other way.
So is it strong coupling inside the condensate or outside the condensate?
The regions cross.
Yeah, so it's...
So you can pick somewhere where the linear dilaton is small, but the condensate is large. You pick a small x minus and a large x plus.
I understand. You've got a null boundary, and the tachyon is condensed on one side and not outside.
Right.
And you're saying that the linear dilaton varies in the other null direction. So it seems like the dilaton is constant along the domain wall. So it should be large either inside or outside.
Let me think about that for a second. Sorry, the picture I always draw in my brain of this is something that ends up looking more like that, and I want to see if that actually makes sense for a moment.
I mean, it is natural. Why should you think for a second?
Right. If the tachyon is getting... I think, actually, this domain wall is at a particular value of x plus. Mm-hmm. So... Right, so if x plus is small here and large here, then x minus is small here and large here. Linear dilaton is large over here. Linear dilaton gets very, very big up here, but is small down here.
Oh, so dilaton does vary.
The tachyon condenses this way.
Okay, dilaton does vary over here.
Right.
I see.
So
in that case, we can ask, is it strong coupling to the future or is it past?
Okay, I see what you're asking. So you're asking, is this region the region we can analyze, or this one?
Yeah, really it should be the question, is the dilaton strong, do you think it's going to be strong near the nucleation event or far in the future?
I believe it ends up being that it's strong in the past.
Oh, okay. Well, that's much better, because you have a natural cutoff, right? You don't expect your wall to go all the way to the past. You expect a natural physical cutoff because you nucleate something. So if it really flows to weak coupling in the future.
I still think that's slightly dangerous because I don't think we actually have a good description of the nucleation point.
I understand, but this is the description you're going to give us. You might argue is an effective description, sort of after the nucleation.
If you pick large x plus and large x minus, yes. But if you pick small x minus, still large x plus, which I guess isn't exactly the same kind of late times. Then you're not getting the.
I think Gary's suggestion is that second limit you mentioned is not physically natural for reasons we might discuss it at the end.
Okay. I'd like to hear about it.
Yeah. But it does sound like this fits with your initial bulk picture then, because you expect the final state to be something where the walls have condensed, the separation of the walls is zero, dilate the coupling. It's weak.
But then I get worried that if we didn't start with a linear dilaton that was small in some sense, then were we really starting from the point we thought we were? And I'm not quite sure about that, which is why I still would like to believe that linear dilaton is a mathematical trick on some level. And I'm not sure that's true, but I would like it to be. Okay, so just to make the point here, of course we know that we always add a term looking like this for the linear dilaton, but if you want to make this supersymmetric, you also have to add a term that depends on the gravitino. We just don't usually care because usually we're setting it to zero. We're not. We need that term. And I should also mention that there's a slight alteration to the supersymmetry variation of the world sheet psi fermions that's dependent on what the linear dilaton profile is. There is actually a way to see here what you're talking about what the which direction V gets larger in versus the tachyon condensate, and we'll see that in just a few moments here. So the tachyon condensates, as I said, that we're interested in are those that are light-like. It's actually slightly a lie. I think we're interested in ones that aren't, but we can analyze ones that are. And in order to keep the, if we add a superpotential, in order to keep it marginal, it turns out that we're required to have the following statement true. Keeping conformal invariance, as I said, means that we have to keep these null. So you find out that the V minus and K plus have to be, the product has to be negative, which is how you can tell that if you make the tachyon large at large X plus, you're making the dilaton small at large X minus. Okay, so then if I go ahead and write what the new terms are that you get from the superpotential, and here I have slightly picked a gauge. I haven't picked a supersymmetric portion of the gauge, I've just picked a conformal part. And that's because it's slightly messier to write things before then. And it's also not easy to check that things are invariant at the quantum level when you still have the major factor around at the front. Partially because I should say that in order to get a marginal profile here, what we really want is we really want to get one half for our conformal dimension of this term here, which is going to be the thing that picks up the k plus x plus. And it's not easy to see what's going on with that when you haven't yet picked the conformal portion of your gauge. So by conformal gauge, I'll use this a lot, I mean just the portion where I've fixed the field bind to be delta, and that's it. I haven't set the gravitino to anything, and I haven't picked any other part of the fermionic gauge. So we'll have to pick some fermionic part in order to completely gauge fix. I'm wondering if there's anything particularly important here. The main thing that's important is that you see all of these extra terms that are showing up here. So of course, it does seem naively like a good idea to go ahead and set the gravitino to zero, because it really does simplify your action a lot. And also it's the traditional thing to do, so we can just look up what the results are for the ghosts and so forth. That's much easier, but it isn't, we think, the right thing to do here. I should make a couple of comments about this action. At this point, I've integrated out all of those FAs. So 31 of them went to zero because nothing strange was happening with the lambdas there. The superpotential term for the last F that couples to the lone fermion lambda plus causes that F to pick up this power here. And here is the one major physics comment that I have to make, as opposed to physics comment, by which I mean space-time picture as opposed to world sheet picture. And that is this term right here. So this term will remain even after we're done with our gauge fixing. And since we're trying to do an analysis at large x plus, we can just look at that term and say, oh, well, it's the case that all degrees of freedom that we try to push into the region are going to get expelled. And so it looks like you get a space-time bubble of nothing at that point. I'll have a little bit more to say about that at the end of the talk. So hopefully we can make a little more progress on that later. But for now, it seems that you could stop at this point, and you could say, okay, fine, there's not anything interesting going on in that region. But we think this is more a sign that we don't have good variables in which to understand what's going on at that region. You can't start with perturbations down here and push them in, but that doesn't mean there's not something going on in here to begin with. It just means we can't reach it from out here. Okay. So there are a couple of things that I wanted to mention in the set of supersymmetry transformations that you get on the world sheet. And the ones that are particularly interesting are this extra piece here was the bit that came when we added the linear dilaton. We had to change that. It turns out that you can rewrite this variation with a power of the auxiliary field F in front of it. And so you can write this. I'm going to get the factor slightly wrong. Sorry, I didn't actually put this on the slide. But it turns out you can write this variation. Let me make sure I get that right. I think it ends up being F B minus 1 over F on epsilon, like that. In other words, there's a sort of indication here that it would be simpler to rescale the field psi by a power of F. And I should mention that that isn't a completely stupid thing to do, because F is this e to the k plus x plus with some factors, and the x plus has trivial OP with itself. So at least it's a well-defined thing to consider a field multiplied by products of this guy. But you still have to be careful with the measure when you do that, so we'll discuss that later. The other thing that I want to mention, we've made this sort of statement that I'm keeping chi around because I expect that the Gravitino will be propagating. Well, then we should look for something that looks like a Goldstino here, because it isn't really like we're breaking a symmetry here, because we're not making a field massive in any sense. It turns out that our Gravitino at late times will be propagating, but still massless. But it is the case that usually you start with your Gravitino providing a constraint, and that ours won't. Ours will actually be a propagating field instead. So in some sense, it's lost, or it's gained a degree of freedom. It's gone from having negative to being massless. So we should look for something that looks like a Goldstino, and it turns out that this lambda plus, if you rescale it by a power of F, and I do mean particularly the one lambda plus that's the lone fermion, the other ones we won't need to worry about, because they've been expressed just by the Kern algebra. It does turn out that it gives you exactly the right transformation to look like a normal Goldstino. Just encouraging that we have something that looks like it. Okay, so we generally stick to conformal gauge, but we need some fermionic set too. Let's use what we just learned about the lambda in order to pick a good gauge. Specifically, let's try setting, oops, that got out of order. Sorry, that's supposed to be a subplus. We're going to try setting this Goldstino to zero, because that's the usual thing that we want to do. Normally, when you're trying to break some symmetry, you take the Goldstone mode and set it to zero. Well, it turns out that this is kind of messy in this case. It gives a constraint equation from taking that action and writing the equation of motion that comes from varying lambda plus. The constraint equation looks like this, which we could solve by setting psi plus to zero for all physical modes. But then we get another constraint equation from the equation of motion that you got from psi plus, and you have to keep continuing this. And it turns out to be really messy, and we couldn't see it as, certainly it didn't seem like there's a good gauge choice. The point of the gauge choice.
So usually in unitary gauge you don't have constraints. Is this,
I guess that maybe that's one of the reasons why it turned out that this wasn't actually a good gauge choice.
I'm trying to think why you don't. You know, normally when you go to unitary gauge,
you don't end up with one.
It's not like Lorentz gauge where you
I'm not sure why it turns out in this case. I mean, maybe that is tied in with why unitary gauge failed. Because we do end up needing constraint, not just one, but several, and so you'd have to quantize some messy system with constraints. And certainly a naive counting of the central charge after trying this gauge fixing wasn't very nice. And it also turns, if you go back and look at the action that we had here, when you just set lambda to zero, you still have all sorts of nasty interaction terms here, and it's not really clear how to turn those into something nice looking. So it seems like that's maybe not our best gauge choice. But we can use this constraint to, this is supposed to be an arrow, we can use this constraint to suggest a gauge choice. And gauge choice we're going to make instead is we're going to make psi plus set to zero. So in some sense, this is a conjugate gauge. All we've done is we've taken what our first constraint was and made that the gauge choice. So all that we've really used, this is just inspiration as to why this is the gauge choice we picked. But of course, what you really want out of a gauge choice is you want to fix your symmetry, and you want to simplify things. You could pick all sorts of nasty gauge choices that fix your symmetry. You just wouldn't, because it doesn't make things look any nicer. But it is the case that this psi plus equal to zero will make things look nicer. So to see how, we can see that we've lost several terms that were present before. Specifically, there was a coupling between chi and psi plus that we've lost. And this looks a little bit simpler, but it isn't certainly completely simple yet. But some parts already are. So we can see that the lambda plus now doesn't have coupling to anything else. It's already free. And we can see that at least at large, I can't show you that just yet. I have to wait a little bit longer. There's one more thing we can do to make this look simpler. And that is to do another rescaling. So I mentioned that we had a hint that this rescaling might be a good idea from looking at the transformation of psi earlier. Oh, good, I did get that right. But it turns out that from looking at the form of the action, we can see that it might be a good idea also, because these last two terms here under this rescaling combine into one canonical-looking kinetic term. So at this point, under this rescaling, we can also see there's one more important thing that happens, which unfortunately I don't think I actually wrote out, and that's that this term here scales as 1 over f. So if we can believe that this is a good scaling to take, if we're only interested in what happens at late times, in other words, or more properly, at large x plus, then we won't have to worry about what happens with this term. And then we're left with only free terms, because these last two become the kinetic free term between chi tilde and psi tilde, and all of these already were here, and this one potential term. And so we actually have a pretty simple system to analyze. But of course there are details, there always are. The details in this question, in this case, become that we have to pay attention to what we're doing as far as these scalings by f, because it's a field-dependent rescaling, and so it tends to do strange things to our determinants, or to what happens with our Louisville mode. And of course, this is all kind of shoved under the rug when I've already picked conformal gauge. You can't really see that. But we still have to pay attention to it. So if I just want to be precise and see where did things come from in terms of our gauge fixing, there'll be two effects. There's one from the gauge fixing, and there's also going to be one from this rescaling of chi and psi. It turns out that the superdeterminant of the Fadeev-Popov method, when we are rewriting our gauge fixing that way, of course we get the normal part that we would expect from the conformal part of the gauge. That gives us just our normal BC ecosystem, and that's not strange. And then we're going to get some other determinant due to the replacement of the gauge supersymmetry parameter epsilon with psi plus. And here we should pay attention. I should make this specifically psi plus, because that's the one we're interested in. We should pay attention particularly to the form of this guy here. I might have that upside down. No, that's right. Which ends up meaning that what we're really interested in is the determinant of this whole thing together, and the F factors matter there. When you are careful about doing the calculation, you get a dependence on them. It's also the case that it's sort of, you know, it looks tempting to go ahead and move this f over here and write this as psi tilde, and then it looks like if you absorbed an f into the epsilon, it's the same thing as absorbing an f into your ghost system. It looks like you might have something pretty simple, and you do. You do get just a beta tilde, gamma tilde. I'm using the tildes to indicate that I've rescaled the ghost by f. They aren't the normal superconformal ghosts. And they aren't even on the same side. They're movers on the other side, which we'll discuss in a bit, but it is interesting. And they also have spin half as opposed to what you normally expect. But you also get some terms dependent on the X plus from the fact that all these rescalings that you're doing are dependent on X plus. So this is the part that you'd normally expect, and this is the extra bit that you get out. And I didn't want to go through the details in the talk because I don't think they're anything but messy, but you can check the appendix of our paper if you're interested in where they come from. Now, this first term, you look at what the form of it is. It's got some D plus X plus and D minus X plus. Let's just hold that in our brains for a second and go on and continue. What do we see happens when we do this rescaling of chi and psi in a careful way? And it turns out, when we're careful about this, this also introduces a subtle Jacobian, again, due to the fact that we have X plus dependent terms. And here, we get one term. I've written this back out of picking, I've picked a partial conformal gauge where we've just fixed it to be the E phi times delta, so that we can actually see the effect of scalar curvature terms like this guy. But this first term here, if you look at it, it turns out to be exactly the same term that you had from the previous scaling. So this part is going to cancel exactly with what we had previously. But then we got to worry about what happens with the second term. Well, it turns out that this term looks like a linear dilaton shift. If I take that term starting in Euclidean signature, and then I want to write it in terms of what we get when we rotate back, it turns out that this term here is exactly a shift by k plus, which is exactly a shift by 12 units of central charge in linear dilaton sector. This 12 units of central charge is important because it's the way that we're going to make the central charge actually cancel.
Isn't V squared null? I mean, isn't V supposed to be a null vector?
V starts out as null, but it's V minus. We've now shifted the linear dilaton to something new with a component in the V plus direction also.
So in the end, the dilaton is not null.
In the end, the dilaton is no longer null. That's right. So this is something that actually has been seen before. I know it shows up in a few different cases for work that Hellerman and Swanson have done. And it tends to be necessary in order to actually keep the system conformal invariant all the way through. I do want to say a little bit more about comparing our work to theirs, because it turns out actually that in the one case where we can compare our method to theirs, we actually don't get the same shift. But we have a slightly different world sheet theory. Even though we think it's the same physical system, they have a different set of ghosts than we do. And so it is possible that it still is the same physical system, just described in a different gauge. So the linear dilaton value itself isn't necessarily a physical quantity. The physical quantity you'd be interested in is something that can observe that. And because the ghosts are different, you may end up with a different result. But the important point here is that, yes, the linear dilaton has actually shifted. It is no longer null. Yes. Wait, no. I think it becomes space-like in our case, which is weird. I'd like it to be. Yeah, you don't think so? How come?
Well, if you really like to describe the timeline of the whole wall, and you might be able to cross the bubble wall.
Yeah,
okay.
You've got a potential that's keeping the bubble.
I don't think it ends up lining up, though, because.
Oh, no, you want it to vary along the bubble wall.
Right.
Yeah. this is going across the.
And this would go in some way against it. I mean, there's still a region in which things make sense. But we're sort of, you know, cutting out pieces of the space-time and only being able to describe some small section of it. And that does have me concerned. But in any case, let's go on and see what, let's do an overview, because we've mentioned several different shiftings and rescalings, and I kind of like to do an overview of what we've got. So let's consider the system before we add the tachyon condensate. So we can have a linear dilaton here, but the central charge, as you said, because it's null initially, the central charge from it is zero. Of course, we get the normal central charge that we'd expect from all of our X fields and from our psi fields. I should mention that it is our convention that the right-hand side is the supersymmetric side and the left-hand side isn't. And I've written this as 31 halves here just so we can see that everything goes to zero in a nice way. But there are a couple of important things that have happened when we switch to our gauge and include this tachyon condensate. One of them is that this linear dilaton shifts by 12 units. We still have the ghosts from conformal gauge fixing. They're the same. We still have the psi i's. They're the same. But we've lost psi plus. And on some level, we kind of lost psi minus, too, because we had to rescale it. And when we rescaled it, if you look at what the conformal dimension of psi minus is ahead of time, the conformal dimension was 0, 1 half. But when you divide by this f, the f has a conformal dimension of 1 half, 1 half. This is psi minus ahead of time. Psi minus with the tilde on it ends up having dimension like that. So in some sense, the psi minus has become completely left moving. It turns out if you keep track of what the conformal dimension is for chi, you get 3 halves on the left again. So both of those have now, I should also mention, of course, if you have a 3 halves minus a half system, that the free fermions, the central charge you get is this minus 11 here. But that should contribute properly on the left, because that's where the conformal dimension is for these guys. The ghosts we get are different, too. The original superconformal ghosts, of course, have an 11 on the right-hand side. Our ghosts, once again, we did the same kind of rescaling, and they're also spin half now instead of 3 halves. They give us a contribution of minus 1 on this side. Upshot is that overall, you move these guys over by this rescaling and by the new gauge choice, and you need this linear dilaton shift in order to keep everything conformal. But it's exactly the right amount to keep everything conformal. So that's something that gives us confidence that what we're doing isn't completely crazy.
So even without the tachyon, I mean, the left-hand side is what you could do with flat space-time, and the right-hand side is an alternate description of the same flat space-time theory?
Yes. The only thing is that on some level what gives you, there's one term that matters, and that is this term that the transverse coupling term that, I should go back and look at exactly what it looks like. I'm going to write it down, slightly funny. It's the term in the action, this guy here, that when you rescale it, it goes as 1 over F. Which is, you could rescale by something that isn't the tachyon condensate. You could rescale by this x plus, by this e to the x plus anyways if you wanted to. It's just that then you wouldn't have a good reason to ignore this term. We only have a good reason to ignore this term because we have the tachyon condensate and we can look at late times. But otherwise, yes, you're right. And there is actually something interesting to say about that. Which I think I can go ahead and say now, so I'll go ahead and say it. And that is that if you turn off mu, you turn off the potential, you turn off the tachyon condensate, you can still do the rescaling, you can still do the analysis. And it turns out that if you calculate what the partition function is, you get the same thing. You'd expect to. That's not surprising. But what this says that's kind of strange is that you might think, well, what if I had the tachyon condensate on, and then I only consider the problem in the case when energies are large enough to get over this wall. In other words, let's consider precisely those states that aren't repelled by this potential, the ones that are energetic enough. And it looks like nothing changes for them. Well, that's not surprising, I guess. They're energetic enough that nothing should change. It's just that we would hope to actually be able to do an analysis for what goes on behind the wall in a way that isn't just blocked by this potential, but everything is actually turned off in this case. There are other cases where that may not be true.
So one more question.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, saying that these are just two alternate descriptions of the same thing makes it sound like this when you're doing Billiton shift, just a gauge effect somehow?
You have to start with actually having a linear dilaton first. That's one thing. And second thing is we really should watch what happens to that one term. The transverse term isn't actually zero. It does actually exist, and you have to pay attention to it, except when you're considering at large x plus. So in some sense, is it a gauge effect? Not quite. It's a gauge effect plus a wait time limit effect, plus the fact that you're taking this large x plus. But I do think it is at least a little bit of gauge effect, and we'll come back to that in a second for an analysis in a different case. Remind me if I don't get there. Okay, so once again, just to highlight what we've got, we do have this shifted linear dilaton. We, interestingly, have a propagating gravitino. It's a free spin 3/2 system. 3/2 for the gravitino, 1 - 1/2 for the psi. And I should also mention that we already talked about that. I should also mention that there is a way to get supersymmetry back again. Our particular gauge is not superconformal. There is no supersymmetry remaining in it in general because the gauge condition we've picked, the two aren't compatible and it doesn't conserve any symmetry. But it is true. If you take all of the gauge transformations that I described earlier and you rescale them by this F, it turns out that you do get a supersymmetry that's restored in the large F limit. We're not entirely certain what this means, but we think it might be, it's certainly interesting that this happens. And I guess on some level it isn't too surprising. We could take this description at late times. Actually, when we told Eva Silverstein about it, this is what she said we should do. Well, I'm not sure I agree, but this is what she said, and it sounds kind of interesting. We could take this just, our world sheet description at late times is just a new string theory. It doesn't have to be attached to anything else. It's something we can write down. It's something we can quantize. We know what it means. And then in that case, the fact that we have some different looking kind of supersymmetry might be something that we can analyze just from that perspective. I personally like the story more as trying to connect it to what happened at early times. Okay, so let me go through the first set of conclusions and then I'll return to your question in a particular case. So we found a good gauge here in which we can view tachyon condensation. And I should state that we're not really viewing tachyon condensation. We're viewing what happens at late times. I can't tell you anything about what happens in the process, which is kind of the same statement as saying, I don't know what happens at this nucleation point. But this is something that is sort of a generic problem in trying to describe time-dependent systems. The first thing we might do is say, oh, it starts off at something we understand. It's very close to an equilibrium system. And then at late times, it's also, again, very close to an equilibrium system. And something funky happens in between. Well, of course, eventually we'd like to be able to describe that something funky. It is, however, true that we keep conformal invariance all the way through, as we showed by the fact that the central charges are actually zeroing out. And this result is actually pretty simple, so we can consider what might happen at late times. It's a free system in this large x plus limit anyways. So then it also turns out this business about picking another gauge isn't some trick that just works for this particular system. You can also consider tachyon condensation in type 0 system. And for this, I think I actually want to back up and look at those charts that we had before. There they are. So for the type 0 system, it's really what you're looking at looks more like just the right-hand side of this chart, only twice. It turns out that you can pick exactly the same gauge. So you pick the left mover psi plus and the right mover psi plus to be zero as your gauge choice. Making that analysis, then you move the original right movers, the ghosts and the right moving gravitino and right moving psi minus, move to the left and pick up this central charge. And the same thing happens with the left movers. They move to the right and pick up the same charge. And you get a linear dilaton shift that is precisely what you need to cancel it. But you'll notice that if you do this shift twice, so if I pull right movers to left movers and then I pull a different set of left movers back over, I'm going to need twice as much central charge to cancel that effect. So let me write that out to make it a little bit more clear. What I'm saying is that...
There's a light up here.
Oh, there is? Lovely. So if I start with just the chi... forget how I called these. I guess these guys are the pluses, these are the minuses. If I start with what... Well, with what you'd get expect in superconformal gauge for these guys, you end up getting very similarly. Sorry, I don't actually have the psi minus written up here, but originally in superconformal gauge, you'd have the left movers here provide you with one unit of central charge on the left when they're still psi plus psi minus, and the right movers provide you with one central charge on the right, and the ghosts give you an 11. Well, then the transformation that you're going to do is to change all of these. You should actually just write these as psi pluses here. You're going to change all of these to the tilted fields. These guys move over to the left-hand side, and you've got psi minus, psi minus minus and chi with a tilde on top, and then the same thing over here, psi and chi. These gammas move over to the left, these gammas move over to the right, and when those movements happen, you again get, just like in our case, this gives us now minus 11 units of central charge, and this is minus 1, and same thing for the guys that move left to right. So initially you had plus 12 units on both sides. Now you have minus 12 added to both sides. So to get things to add up again, you need a plus 24 on both sides. So we would expect, and we haven't done this analysis in super amounts of detail because I didn't feel like dealing with four Fermi terms, but we don't think they should contribute to this, so it should be okay. We expect that the linear dilaton should shift sufficiently to give us 24 units of central charge. The reason this is interesting is that Hellermann and Swanson did a paper talking about what happens in type 0 tachyon condensation, and they had two things that were different from our case. And one is they did end up with a spin 3 halves, 1 half propagating system, but they didn't see it as the gravitino. They stayed in superconformal gauge, so they had to work pretty hard and do all sorts of field transformations to get to what turns out to be the same propagating degrees of freedom. But it's hard to see that. And it is also the case that they have their linear dilaton shift being only 12. But they still have the superconformal ghosts. We have these different beta tilde gamma tilde ghosts. And so our hope is that the theories are still actually equivalent at the level of a conformal field theory, and that you just need to see that somehow linear dilaton with 12 units plus superconformal ghosts is the same as linear dilaton with 24 units plus our different set of bosonic ghosts. And we haven't looked into whether or not that's true, but if it is true, then it's the case that just the number of the linear dilaton doesn't necessarily give you a physical quantity, and what you really want to be discussing is what the observables would be. So is the value of the linear dilaton a gauge effect? Partially. But the fact that it shifts is showing up as the same in both cases. Okay. And I did want to talk briefly about some possible future directions that might be interesting. We are hoping that this application of picking a new gauge is something that can be used for lots of other systems. For example, it would be really nice if we could actually find some intelligent gauge that made discussing this same case only in a time-dependent fashion doable, because then maybe we could actually discuss what happens at that nucleation point. That would be exciting. Even if we couldn't do that, maybe it's possible to pick some gauge. I was making the argument that the superconformal gauge is a good idea at early times, but at late times you want to pick our new psi plus equals to zero gauge. Well, in electromagnetism, we have these nice arc C gauges where you can do some gradual variation between those. We have some possible gauges that might be do that same kind of interpolation. It doesn't turn out that the world sheet theory in any of the ones we've come up with looks nice, so we can't actually do an interpolation at this point, or we can't really analyze it. I can write down a gauge that does it, but I can't tell you anything about it except at early times and late times. But that doesn't mean one doesn't exist. It means we haven't come up with it yet. Something else that I'd love to be able to do, I'm sure I'm not the only one who feels that way. It would be nice to be able to actually give a description of what's going on in a time-dependent fashion for the VRST. Here we have a good description at early times and one at late times, but it's the same situation. I can't say anything about what happens in a time-dependent way. But before we worry about that, if we want a description of what's going on as this condensation occurs, either looking at it from the case of some nucleation site and asking what happens in the neighborhood of that nucleation site, or looking at it in the case of some something that starts as a macroscopic fall off rather than something in a local point. Either way, something that we should discuss, and I'd like to hear any ideas you guys may have about it, it's not something we have an answer to at this point, is what are the good physical observables? If we want to be able to describe it, well, what do we want to know? What can we actually say about it that would be interesting? Since it seems like we may be somewhat near being able to actually discuss what happens, at least at late times and early times, well, it's a much harder problem to discuss what happens in the middle. But if we knew what was interesting in terms of physical observables, maybe we could start them at early times, see what happens at late times. Of course, the big hope here is to eventually get to be able to give a description of systems that change dramatically over time. Petter likes to say that this is similar to the setup in statistical mechanics, that originally statistical mechanics were very good at describing things at equilibrium, and then they could do things near equilibrium, and then eventually there became these methods to do things in a completely non-equilibrium way. Well, maybe the same thing is true of string theory. So, thanks go to, I actually didn't write Petter's name up here, but it should be. We'll have to imagine that. Don't tell him. Of course, both KITP and UCSB for hosting me, and the seminar organizers for inviting me. And Petter will write it up there.
Okay, so I mean, several times you pointed to this sort of model of a nucleation of a bubble that expands out as sort of motivation for this light-like condensation. And I guess I have trouble with that. I'm perfectly happy with this as a study of light-like tachyon condensation
sure.
and all of the sort of results you obtain. But you know, the bubble comes about when the walls, if you think about a brain anti-brain system, if they're separated by more than a string length or so, there is no tachyon, right?
Sure.
The strings are all massive. And so the potential, you know, there's a local minimum and then a barrier and then something's unstable. And the bubble that nucleates is sort of a tunneling that goes through the bubble. You're starting with a system where the brain and anti-brain are essentially on top of each other. There's a perturbative. You're sitting at the top of a potential. So the instability there is just rolling down the potential.
Sure.
You don't need to nucleate any bubble. And so I would think that, you know, a more likely scenario is if you have something much bigger, you know, more like a homogeneous mode, just condensing in some time-like way.
I think you're right, and that's part of the reason why I was saying that I'd like to be able to pick a gauge that actually does start with some sort of condensation that happens in a time-like fashion that has some good spatial extent to start with. I don't have a reason to believe it, but it sure would be nice if these methods can be applied to that case as well. And it's something I'd like to look into. I think you're right that we have looked at a very particular case, and in some sense that case isn't really mappable to what really would happen in a physical system when you start with this. I think that's valid.
In deep brain, deep system, there's a tachyon, but there's also an instanton of the DBI action. If you take the two brains close to each other, there's a sort of a throat.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to take them not too close, right?
But could that be enough? I mean, would your objection apply to that system as well? In the sense that one way of looking at it, mm-hmm. looks like it's tunneling, but the other way it looks like it's turning.
Well, in the DBI case, if the brains are separated by more than a string length or so, this and they don't sort of come together by the Casimir force, but that's the other dominant thing in the houses come together, but if they're stable, like some houses, they don't come together at a pattern point. Then this tunneling, this instant time of the DBI action, is the dominant rate of ADK. If they're basically on top of each other or very close, first of all, the action for the DBI instant time is very small, so that's not really suppressed. But I'm not sure, it seems like a different picture to think about lots of these, lots of little instanton bubbles nucleating, not quite the same thing as a homogeneous tachyon. But there's no, the idea is that it's just unstable, it doesn't have to tunnel anything. So I don't see why a bubble is the right picture.
Would you think that maybe a bubble would be a better picture? Our system clearly isn't describing this. We think it is starting with coincident brains, but would a bubble be a better picture if you were starting with brains that were farther apart? Because you still do have that instanton.
Sure.
That's not what we're talking about.
Yeah, the brains are far enough apart that there is no perturbative tachyon, then I think, yeah.
It's just not the same system.
Then it is, then the bubble is the way it decays.
So what was the option about the end? So what's the physical picture about the late time
systems? There are two things that I can say. One is all the degrees of freedom are expelled if they're low enough energy by this potential. So you do get in the generic interpretation of this is that you really do have a bubble of nothing because you can't get anything in there. However, you can get some things in there if you concentrate only on things that are high enough energy. And then it's the case that, as I sort of alluded to, it's true that you get the same partition function if you set mu to zero in this new gauge as you got in the old case at late x plus. And that's basically because, I don't know if there's any easy way to see it. You can basically see it because moving this gamma beta over to the other side gave you something that was a spin one-half system, but at the same time when you move this I, you got back a spin three-halves system, and it turns out that they give you the same result. And if you pay attention to the zero modes, they work out too. We didn't do this in our paper. This is something we've only done in the last few weeks, but we don't really know what the meaning is, other than that, of course, if you're considering things that are higher energy than the level of the tachyon condensate, then of course you don't see it. So there's not much interesting to be said. What we would like to be able to do, and I'm hoping maybe in the type zero case that this will be true, is to be able to follow and see what happens inside the region of tachyon condensation in terms of the world sheet variables. The reason this might be possible in type zero is that it turns out you can't write the same kind of potential term. And what I'm unclear about is whether our really heuristic analysis that I kind of sketched on the board for you, which really is about the level we've done it for type zero, if this analysis follows through for the same kind of tachyon condensation as the one which Hahnemann and Swanson considered, then we could actually ask questions about what happens at the physics at late times. And the few things that we can say automatically about that are that we do have a system that should be easy to analyze because it's all these free fermions. Or free scalars that aren't interacting with anything.
Any other questions? And we're moving on to dinner tonight, so we're going to be around 6.